This weather forecast is made possible with support from the University of Illinois Employees Credit Union, a member-owned and not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to serve the complete financial needs of its members. The University of Illinois Employees Credit Union. Information is available on the web at uiecu.org.
A cold front will track across Iowa and Wisconsin today, bringing scattered showers and thunderstorms as far south as in the northern third of Illinois today. Ahead of this front, a southerly wind will develop, boosting temperatures several degrees above average. Another weather system will quickly move into the Midwest tonight, again bringing scattered showers and storms from northern Missouri to southern Wisconsin. As this front works to the southeast, rain chances will increase across central Illinois beginning late tomorrow and into Friday. High temperatures today will reach the upper 60s to mid-70s across the Midwest, while lows tonight will drop into the 40s and 50s. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny, the high 72, the wind from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 52, the wind out of the south from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, the high 75, the wind from the south at 10 to 15 with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, the low 55, the wind from the south tomorrow night at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Friday, showers and thunderstorms are likely. It will be cooler. Look for a high in the low 60s. The wind from the northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Friday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and a low in the low 40s. Saturday, partly sunny with a high in the mid 50s. Saturday night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana were in the 60s. Sunshine abundant across the two states. At Rockford, 69. At O'Hare, 65. In Bloomington, it was 66 degrees. Also 66 at Carbondale. In Mattoon, 63 degrees. South Bend reported 62 degrees. Lafayette, 64. Indianapolis, 61. And in Terre Haute, it was 65. Willard Airport reported a sunny sky at the top of the hour, 67 degrees. The dew point, 41. The relative humidity, 38%. The wind out of the south at 12, gusting to 18. The barometric pressure, 30.18 and falling. And at 1240, 66 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. You may never have had an opportunity to attend an elite university, but now you can take classes at one online. Four major universities, Stanford, Princeton, the University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Michigan, are joining forces with a Silicon Valley startup called Coursera. Together, they plan to offer free online classes in more than three dozen subjects. The professors involved think this interactive online education could transform higher education. NPR's Steve Henn reports.
Last year, when Andrew Ng, a computer science professor at Stanford, put his machine learning class up online and opened enrollment to the world, more than 100,000 students signed up.
I think all of us were surprised.
Andrew Ng had posted lectures online before, but this class was different.
This was actually a class where you can participate as a student and get homeworks and assessments.
And get a grade. Not course credit, but a grade. The class was interactive. There were quizzes and online forums, were teaching assistants, fellow students, and even Andrew himself answered questions. In the end, tens of thousands of students did all the same work and took all the same tests that Stanford students took. Thousands passed. Jim Plummer is the dean of engineering.
Stanford has always been a place where we were not afraid to try bold new things, often without knowing exactly what the consequences were going to be. And this is an instance of that, I think.
Now Andrew Ng and a Stanford colleague, Daphne Kohler, are launching a company called Coursera to bring classes from elite universities to students around the world for free online.
Really, by providing what is a truly high-quality educational experience to so many students for free, I think we can really change many, many people's lives.
Princeton, the University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Michigan will join Stanford, and two venture capitalists are investing more than $15 million in the company. Kohler believes online classes could bring university education to millions of people who are now effectively cut off. But to do this, these classes have to be effective at teaching more than just computer science. How are they going to teach hundreds of thousands of students to write?
You've asked the right question, which is, you're really going to try to do a poetry course?
They are, and in fact, Al Filreis is the guy they've roped into doing just that.
Yeah.
Filreis is a poetry professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and starting next fall, he'll be teaching modern and contemporary American poetry online for free. Now, he knows he's not going to be able to grade thousands of essays, but he wants people to think about the poems he's teaching and engage each other.
Poetry is really good in this setting because you can read it alone and get so much out of it and be perfectly fine with it. The next step is hang out with some intuitively smart people and collectively, together, collaboratively, let's read the poem together.
So what will a poetry class trying to engage thousands sound like? Filreis says it'll sound something like this.
Today we're going to be talking about a poem by Lynn Dinh. It's called Eating Fried Chicken.
He's been hosting a poetry discussion podcast for years.
I hate to admit this, brother, but there are times when I'm eating fried chicken, when I think about nothing else but eating fried chicken.
So who's the brother being addressed in the first line?
Interesting. I thought of that as, you know, Philadelphia speak, maybe African-American vernacular.
It could be anyone, or it could be an African-American brother. It could be a presumptuous address.
I was thinking the same thing, especially
in his class this fall, Filreis will discuss poetry with a small group of students, while potentially thousands of others make comments online. And Coursera is building a system, kind of like Yelp, that will let those students value each other's comments. The most valued and respected will rise to the top. Filreis says he's excited to give this a try, and it's possible that this fall he could reach more students with poetry than he's done in his entire career. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
In Nebraska, there's a political showdown over taxpayer funding of prenatal care for illegal immigrants. The fight has divided the state in some unusual ways. Fred Knapp of NET News reports.
In this Republican-dominated state, government leaders often line up together like the endless rows of corn you see out the windows driving cross-country on Interstate 80. But lately, a political tornado's ripped through this orderly scene. Here's Republican Governor Dave Heineman reading a letter he wrote to a fellow Republican, Mike Flood, Speaker of Nebraska's officially nonpartisan legislature.
Dear Speaker Flood, I am extraordinarily disappointed with your support of taxpayer-funded benefits for illegal aliens.
Heineman was referring to a bill he subsequently vetoed that would restore publicly funded prenatal care for women in the country illegally. Until 2 years ago, Nebraska was one of about 15 states providing that benefit. It dropped the coverage when the federal government said the state couldn't use Medicaid funds, although it offered to continue funding under another program. Governor Heineman frames the issue as one of benefits to illegal immigrants. Speaker Flood, a leading abortion opponent, says the pregnant illegal immigrants will ultimately give birth to babies who will be U.S. citizens. He says providing them with prenatal care is consistent with his opposition to abortion.
If I'm going to stand up in the legislature and protect babies at 20 weeks from abortion, and hordes of senators and citizens are going to stand behind me, and that's pro-life, then I'm going to be pro-life when it's tough too.
The issues exposed a fault line between anti-illegal immigrant sentiment and anti-abortion groups, but it's also brought together an unusual coalition. Among those supporting the bill is the politically influential Nebraska Right to Life organization. Julie Schmidt-Albin is the group's executive director.
We don't want to distinguish that because of a baby's circumstances or in whose womb that baby resides, that dictates whether that baby receives care or not.
Another supporter is the Nebraska Appleseed Center for Law in the Public Interest, which advocates for immigration reform and access to universal health care. Jennifer Carter is the center's public policy director.
These moms, they're members of our neighbors, they are our coworkers in cases, they're in our communities and they're helping contribute to our communities, and so believe that providing this kind of prenatal care coverage to their children is appropriate.
Still, Governor Heineman, backed by what Republican Party polls say is a clear majority of voters, remains adamantly opposed. even though he calls himself strongly pro-life.
Most Nebraskans, and I agree, we support prenatal care. But in the case of illegal immigrants, it should be done by churches, private organizations, charities, private individuals, not the use of taxpayer funds.
Supporters of the bill on both sides of the abortion debate cite their own polls in support and say the savings from avoiding intensive care for babies born without prenatal care would outweigh the costs of the program. With the governor turning up the political heat, the question now is whether enough legislators will vote to override the veto. That vote is scheduled for later today. For NPR News, I'm Fred Knapp in Lincoln, Nebraska.
The U.S. Supreme Court handed generic drug makers a major victory in a patent case yesterday. Generic manufacturers had been barred from using the courts to challenge patents given to their brand name rivals. The court ruled unanimously that generics do have that right. It sounds like an obscure legal battle, but as Yuki Noguchi reports, it could have a big impact on the industry.
There's a diabetes drug approved for three uses. Novo Nordisk has a patent on one of the uses, but to the FDA, the company described its patent broadly, applying it to the other two uses. Generic drug maker Caraca wanted to challenge Novo Nordisk's description, but because the FDA doesn't issue such corrections, Caraca could not make generics for the other unpatented uses of the drug. Jeff Krause is CEO of Crystal Research, an independent research firm. He says this decision is big for a generic drug industry that's $225 billion in size and growing.
So you've now got a very large market with a potential for smaller companies to go and challenge the 800-pound gorilla.
He says companies like Caraco have a new tool for challenging their rivals. But Novo Nordisk General Counsel James Sheehan denies this is a blow to big drug brands. He says disputes about patent descriptions are relatively rare.
It affects a relatively narrow area of commerce.
In a related case, Caraco is disputing the validity of the Novo Nordisk patent. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Today is the first day of our spring pledge drive, but we won't be interrupting our regularly scheduled programs today. Thanks to the many listeners who contributed early, you raised over $26,000 in member support. Please help us reach our member participation goal of 1,100 pledges in this fund drive. Call 217-244-9455 or contribute online now at willpledge.org. Thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 18th of April, 2012. It was on this day, 1958, the U.S. government dropped its treason charges against the poet Ezra Pound, and he was released from St. Elizabeth's Mental Hospital in Washington, where he'd been held for almost 13 years for having made radio speeches from Rome during World War II, praising Mussolini and the fascists, and blaming the war on the Jews. Ezra Pound was 72. He had been visited during those 13 years by an odd combination of white supremacists who liked his politics and distinguished American writers who admired his poetry or his history of generosity to other writers, including Robert Frost, who testified in his behalf and said, "None of us can bear the disgrace of our letting Ezra Pound come to his end where he is. It would leave too woeful a story in American literature." And it's the birthday of the beat poet Bob Kaufman, born in New Orleans, 1925, who helped found Beatitude magazine. His books include Solitudes, Crowded with Loneliness, which came out in 1965. Here's a poem for today by Robert Bly, entitled The Starfish. It is low tide, fog. I have climbed down the cliffs from Pierce Ranch to the tide pools. Now the ecstasy of the low tide, kneeling down alone. In 6 inches of clear water, I notice a purple starfish with 19 arms. It is a delicate purple, the color of old carbon paper or an attic dress. At the webs between the arms, sometimes a more intense sunset red glows through. The fingers are relaxed, some curled up at the tips, with delicate rods, apparently globes on top of each, as at world fairs, waving about. The starfish slowly moves up the groin of the rock, then back down. Many of its arms rolled up now, lazily, like a puppy on its back. One arm is especially active and curves up over its own body, as if a dinosaur were looking behind him. How slowly and evenly it moves! The starfish is a glacier going 60 miles a year. It moves over the pink rock by means I cannot see, and into marvelously floating, delicate brown weeds. It is about the size of the bottom of a